Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Intelligence Matters ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today.
Afghanistan has dominated the news for weeks, and many of you, our listeners, have asked us to do an episode on the issue. So today, we're bringing you a conversation that I was involved in at the Michael V. Hayden Center at George Mason University with two other former intelligence community officers, Mike Vickers and Phil Riley, both previous guests on our show. The discussion was moderated by our producer, Olivia Gazis. We'll be right back with that discussion. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here and welcome. Let's spend just a few minutes again on the past, starting at the final stages of the Cold War. And Mike Vickers, I will start with you. As Larry mentioned, you were an integral part of the CIA covert action program that supported the Mujahideen and the anti-communist resistance movement, which ultimately drove the Soviets from Afghanistan. At the time, a very meaningful victory, but had some tragic consequences for Afghanistan, which descended into civil war, and for the United States, which ultimately witnessed the horrors of 9/11. So can you start us off with just a little bit of context by explaining who the groups were that we were supporting at the time, what happened when we withdrew that support, and how we arrived as a consequence at the birth of both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda?
Sure, happy to. And good evening, Olivia and everyone else. So I became the Afghanistan Covert Action Program Officer and Chief Strategist in summer of 1984. So I go back a long ways with Afghanistan. And some of the people who were my resistance commanders, prominent commanders actually leading fighting forces in Afghanistan, ended up having very prominent positions in the Afghan government that I worked with when I became an assistant secretary and undersecretary. So I had a lot of continuity over four decades. What happened after we won this great historic victory that helped contribute to the demise of the Soviet Empire was that we essentially turned our backs on Afghanistan and focused on consolidating the gains in Europe, the primary theater of the Cold War, with the reunification of Germany and liberation of Eastern Europe. And then a thing called the Pressler Amendment caused us to essentially break relations with Pakistan when their nuclear program got too far along for President Bush to be able to certify that they weren't heading toward a nuclear weapon. And so that led to the time of troubles that, as you mentioned, a civil war occurred among Mujahideen fighters. The Pakistanis had their favorite, a fellow named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. And then in 1996, the Taliban took over, and a lot of the Afghan population was just hoping for an end to decades of war at that point. They didn't get it. And then in 1996, as Michael can talk about better than I, bin Laden went from Sudan to Afghanistan, and then those events led to 9/11. I would argue that 9/11 was as much or more a policy failure as it was an intelligence failure. We had opportunities to deal with that sanctuary. One of the big lessons we learned from that experience was not allow sanctuaries after that. And so with that, I'll stop.
Thank you. And Mike, we'll revisit a version of this question later. But while we're on you, I just want to ask, you've long said that the U.S. committed an error at the end of the war, the Cold War, by disengaging from the region. And I wanted to ask if you still think now that continued U.S. engagement then might have prevented the Taliban from coming to power. And do the developments today make you reconsider that view?
Yes, I think it's possible it would have. The circumstances were quite difficult. The U.S. had a lot on its plate at the end of the Cold War, 1989 to 1992, before Afghanistan really descended into hell. And so it might have made a real difference to stay engaged. The challenge would have been how to do that with an estranged U.S. relationship with Pakistan because of their nuclear weapons program. And so that's what would have reduced a lot of our leverage and complicated it, but we would have been far better off. I mean, my old boss, Bob Gates, says that it was one of the biggest mistakes we made after the Cold War to disengage. And I agree with him. Also, you know, the Afghans really played a major role in helping us win the end game of the Cold War. You know, 1 million of them died, 1/3 of the population was put into exile. So to pick up and leave was maybe not the right moral as well as strategic decision. And today I think we made a mistake as well by leaving completely.
We'll definitely dive into that shortly. Michael, just as a little bit more historic context, Michael Morrell, I'll call you Michael, and Mike Vickers, Mike. So let's have you pick up the thread where Mike left off. In the early 90s, the CIA is, of course, watching Al-Qaeda gain potency. It's tracking the rise to prominence of who was first cast as a terror financier, later cast as a terrorist, Osama bin Laden, of course. It wasn't until the late 90s that the U.S.'s focus on Al-Qaeda really expanded beyond the agency. You got more resources dedicated to tracking it. Can you talk a little bit about what the conditions at that time were that allowed Al-Qaeda to grow, to organize, and to become capable of carrying out these really complex attacks that culminated, of course, in 9/11?
Sure. First of all, it's great to be with everybody tonight. And Olivia, thank you for moderating. Mike said it earlier, and I'll say it maybe a little more directly. There is nothing as important as safe haven to a terrorist group. It allows them to operate, to plan, to train without worry, right? Without consequence of somebody coming after them. And that's what the Taliban in Afghanistan prior to 9/11 gave to Al-Qaeda. And I don't believe the 9/11 attacks would have been possible without the Taliban providing that safe haven. Interestingly, the Taliban was not supportive of Al-Qaeda conducting attacks around the world, but they didn't do anything in response to the attacks against our embassies in East Africa. They didn't do anything in response to the many threats around the time of the millennium that were pinned back on bin Laden, and they didn't do anything in response to the USS Cole. And in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, they had an opportunity. The United States gave the Taliban an opportunity to avoid war by turning bin Laden over or by taking action against him themselves. And they chose not to do that. So, you know, that takes us from where Mike left off to the days after 9/11.
Which is where we'll have Phil, you jump in, because we are having this conversation almost to the day when you and nine other men who made up the Jawbreaker team traveled to Afghanistan to meet up with the Northern Alliance. That was September 26, 2001. And it was a liaison mission, not a military operation, right? So can you give us just a little bit of background on what the mission was and how cultivating that relationship with the Northern Alliance factored in the U.S. military effort that followed, and maybe a little bit about how it might factor today?
Sure. Thank you very much, Olivia. And General Hayden, thank you for your continued leadership. The CIA had a relationship with the Northern Alliance. The Northern Alliance controlled a small sliver of northeastern Afghanistan in the fall of 2001. It was the only unoccupied being the rest of the country held by the Taliban. And so it enabled CIA, which had assets in the region and a capability to put people on the ground. As you said, 26 September 2001, our mission was to bring the Northern Alliance to our side completely, to pave the way for the introduction of what we assumed correctly to be a large U.S. military entry, and to also commence the hunt for Al-Qaeda and UBL and those responsible for the attacks on 9/11. I should say that on the 9th of September, Ahmad Shah Massoud, the head of the Northern Alliance, was assassinated by Al-Qaeda, and that was a galvanizing event that brought the Northern Alliance firmly into the U.S. Fold, and that enabled us to bring in U.S. Army Special Forces, and let me say that it was once a Green Beret many years ago, but it was the absolute perfect tool for the U.S. military to select, and working joined with CIA teams and U.S. military Special Forces Green Berets, about 300 people were able to ultimately defeat the Taliban along with superior U.S. air power within a period of about 2 months.
So we're leaving a gap, but we'll revisit some of what happened in the intervening 20 years in the conversation to follow. But that was a helpful encapsulation of, I think, roughly 50 years in 10 minutes. So thank you very much. Let's talk a little bit about today, current developments, starting with the decision to leave Afghanistan. I think each of you has previously publicly articulated a view that some U.S. presence would be necessary to keep the Taliban at bay. This week, we heard top generals testify that that was their personal view as well. We assume that was their recommendation to the president as well, to retain at least 2,500 troops on the ground in Afghanistan while pursuing a negotiated agreement. So maybe we can just do a round robin and ask all three of you. I am curious when this sense of inevitability arose. At what point did it become clear to you that a Taliban takeover was unavoidable absent a U.S. presence? Was there a particular moment or turning point when that became apparent? Why don't we start with Mike Vickers?
Well, there was some hope that the Afghan government and the Afghan security forces that we had invested a lot in would be able to hold together. But we should have learned from our experiences about the rapid collapse of Iraqi security forces in 2015 in northern Iraq against ISIS, and then Yemeni security forces that we'd also invested a lot in that same year against the Houthis who took over Yemen. You know, militaries can collapse really rapidly. And General McKenzie has testified that the Afghan government and much of Afghan security forces essentially saw the writing on the wall with the decision for the U.S. to actually withdraw, you know, beyond the peace agreement, or as H.R. McMaster has called it, the surrender agreement negotiated by the previous administration. And so then they started making deals with the Taliban. You know, and the Taliban at first took over districts and provincial areas, but then it really sped up rapidly. And I think, you know, the end game still went faster than people thought, but timelines kept moving up about how fast the government might collapse.
So indications as far back as 2015. Michael Morrell, what's your view on this?
Yeah, to answer your question, Olivia, you know, when did I believe that absent U.S. forces on the ground, the Taliban, you know, would take over? When did I first realize that? You know, I have to tell you, it goes way back to the surge, to the Obama surge. When 130,000 US troops were not able to win the war, when the Taliban fought 130,000 US troops essentially to a stalemate, you know, that told me that this war you know, wasn't winnable, number one. And number two, if we left, the Taliban would take over. So that goes way back for me. You know, I agree with Mike on kind of the timeline this year. But the realization to me that the Taliban would take over absent U.S. forces goes way back.
Phil, how do you see?
Which is why we kept them there for so long, right?
Yeah.
I would have to agree with both of my colleagues. I thought without U.S. troop presence and U.S. air power to support the Afghans, they would collapse. I did not think in the short period of time that they did, but I thought it was, in fact, inevitable. And so when we made the decision ultimately that Trump made and then that President Biden then sort of doubled down on, we are leaving, zeroizing U.S. troop presence, I thought it would just be a matter of time. But again, I like it, everyone else did not predict it as short as it was, but it was inevitable.
This is a little bit more of a policy question, but let's do a quick round robin on this one too. And that's the Biden administration's rationale for leaving now. You know, they've argued that they were bound by the deal struck by the Trump administration, and that they risked an escalation with the Taliban if that withdrawal didn't happen by the end of August. Did you find that rationale coherent? Did you find it persuasive? Let's do it in the same order with Mike Vickers first.
No, I don't. I mean, you know, there aren't too many policy continuities between the Trump administration and Biden administration, as there weren't between the Obama administration and the Trump administration. Trump administration pulled out of the Iran deal. Biden administration wants to go back in. So why this is some special case, I don't know. Phil really hit the nail on the head in a sense. The things that kept Afghanistan together were really U.S. assistance and engagement and then air power. You know, and as long as we maintained U.S. air power, the Taliban couldn't win. You know, so Michael correctly raised the point that, you know, even with the surge, we couldn't defeat the Taliban. We actually pushed them back in terms of area they controlled back to about 2006 levels, but we couldn't defeat them because of the Pakistan sanctuary. But the paradox of this is neither could the Taliban win when we had 7,500 or fewer troops in country from 2015 till 2021. It was only when we pulled out air power and signaled we were leaving that the state collapsed.
Michael?
You know, I hardly ever disagree with my really good friend, Mike Vickers, but I'm going to disagree just a little bit here. I don't think the choice for President Biden was leave or stay with 2,500. I think the choice was leave or plus up. And I don't know exactly what the number was, but I think a plus up would have been required. 7,500, 10,000, I don't know what the right number is, but we needed, if we were gonna stay, we would need to add more troops in order to provide force protection for those 2,500 and for all the civilians in the country. 2,500 simply wasn't enough. And I think that President Biden judged correctly that that was not politically possible, that the American people were done with this war. And could he have persuaded the American people that we needed to stay and to actually plus up our troops? I don't know, I doubt it. Clearly his heart wasn't in such a public relations campaign. So I think he did face an extraordinarily difficult decision. And you know, for my money, I think he probably made the right one given the choices he faced.
Phil, you can choose a panelist to agree or disagree with.
I'm going to agree with Mike Vickers. Sorry, Michael. I think this could have been done with 2,500, and that's based on conversations with some of the generals, most senior generals involved in this. Bear in mind, too, 2,500 would be our figure. We have allies who were still there, still putting up a fight. And there were other elements of the U.S. government actively working the target sets. I think it could have held. Had a decision been made to maybe delay a bit, you probably could have negotiated that with the Taliban. And I've seen other people say it. Had they just pushed the departure into the winter months, It could have enabled some time gap separation between our departure potentially and the collapse that ensued. But to do it at the height of the fighting season with the Taliban in full vigor, especially when that was being telegraphed to us with the collapse of all the provinces, I think it just was a bad decision.
You know, Olivia, the other thing I would say here, which my co-panelists probably won't agree with either, is I don't think it's appropriate for a president of the United States to send young men and young women into harm's way with so much of the public opposed to the war. I don't think that's fair to those soldiers to do that. And we're not talking about a 60-40, 55-45, 60-40 here. We're talking about a very large percentage of the American public that was just done with this thing.
Mike or Phil, do you want to engage on that question, or should we?
I agree. I mean, you make a good point, Michael. I mean, the vast majority of the American public wanted out even after what happened. The majority now also think it was done probably poorly or handled poorly, the departure, but they're still overwhelmingly supportive of being gone. So to your point, that's right. The president had that going for him and was responding to the proponents of the American public.
So I agree with those points. I find it hard to believe, knowing what has happened, that people don't wish they could revise this decision a little bit. Given the cost to America. And so we'll just have to see over time.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with more of a discussion on Afghanistan.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So let's talk a little bit about the intelligence that would have informed the policy decision to leave and in what time frame that all should have been done. Both Phil and Mike have said that it happened faster than foreseen. We've heard that repeatedly from the administration and the Pentagon, including this week in testimony, that there was no intelligence indicating Kabul would fall in 11 days. Secretary Austin said it was a surprise and it would be dishonest to claim otherwise. Weeks ago, the DNI also put out a statement saying that the Taliban takeover happened more quickly than anticipated, presumably within the IC. So does that suggest, and this is to you, Michael Morrell, does that suggest that there was a shortcoming in the intelligence? Assuming that level of precision wasn't there, should it have been offered by the IC?
Yeah, so this is a tough question, right? Because I haven't seen the intelligence. I haven't seen the intelligence analysis. I haven't seen what was both provided to the president before he made his decision on whether the Taliban would take over, and if so, how long would that take? That's a very important judgment. And I haven't seen the evolution of that judgment, post announcement in April through early August. So I don't know what the intelligence community said. I find it hard to believe that the intelligence community got this as wrong as some people have said. I'd be shocked at that. In fact, while I haven't seen it, I've heard people say, people who know say that at least the CIA feels pretty good about the judgments that it made. In terms of the judgment that was made prior to the president's decision, I think one of the things you have to think about is, let's say they said a year, right? Let's say they said 6 months. I don't know what they said, but let's just say for the sake of argument, they said a year. The question becomes, when does the clock start ticking, right? When does that year start? Is it when the last boot leaves the ground? No. Is it when the first boot leaves the ground? No, I think it's when the president made the decision, because that's when the psychology changed for everybody in Afghanistan. It was the moment in, you know, when the president made the decision in April, it was the moment when the Taliban knew that it was going to win. And it was the moment when the Afghan government knew that it was going to lose. And if you looked at what happened, right, in the immediate aftermath of that announcement, the Taliban accelerated the extent to which they were surrounding provincial capitals. You know, nobody should be surprised with what they intended to do when they were surrounding those provincial capitals. The number of desertions among Afghan security forces skyrocketed after the announcement. They either went home or they flipped to the Taliban. And it should be no surprise to anybody that the Afghan senior Afghan government leaders would start thinking about saving their own necks, right? And I saw the first two things publicly. So that was no secret. And I'd be shocked if the intelligence community didn't see the third one as well. So I think there's a little blame game going on here. People are always very quick to throw the intelligence community under the bus. The last point I would make is, you know, throughout the history of the 20 years, CIA was by far the most pessimistic agency about how the war was going. We did two annual reports. We did an annual report called the District Assessments, where we looked at who controlled which district, whether the Taliban controlled it, whether the government controlled it, or whether it was contested. And we also did an annual report on the Afghan security forces and their capabilities and will to fight. And we were always pessimistic in every single case. And in every case that I was involved in as a senior leader, both as the head of analysis at CIA and then as the deputy director, the United States military pushed back really hard on these assessments, saying you're wrong, your analysts aren't on the ground, they don't understand the progress we're making. So, intelligence is being the whipping boy here, I'm almost certain.
Mike, let me get your take on that. You know, so do you think it's fairly described as an intelligence failure? And then can you address a little bit of what Michael was just laying out, which is, you know, there was a fair amount of public messaging about this, that there was a divergence between what the CIA was saying, what the DIA assessments were about the resiliency of Afghan forces, you know, the fact that CIA were routinely pessimistic by comparison. I mean, how much would that or should that divergence of views have affected the choices that policymakers were making?
So my friend Jim Clapper likes to say that there's only two conditions in life, policy success and intelligence failure. And I don't see how one could call this an intelligence failure. You know, you start with the knowledge that we're concerned about the durability. Now, the country might devolve into civil war. That was certainly a plausible scenario. But again, you have the examples of 2014 in both Iraq and Yemen about how quickly militaries we'd invested a lot could collapse. And it's not because of force ratios or anything else. You know, psychology is what really drives this, and often, and how our militaries break up. And then, as Michael said, as you walk from April to August, we're on policy autopilot, but the world, you know, is not standing still for us. You have a bunch of events that are showing you that things may be much worse than you think, and you ought to be able to adapt to that. And then third, it's not possible for intelligence to tell you that Kabul's going to fall in 10 days. You know, so if you start escalating what could happen from, say, 6 months to 30 days, that's a big red light blinking for policymakers. And, you know, and policymakers live in a world of imperfect intelligence, and they have to make decisions. And so to lay the blame on this, on intelligence, or for that matter, on the Afghans, I think is honestly disingenuous.
Olivia, can I just add one point? This whole nobody told me that Kabul was going to fall in 11 days line is a total red herring, right? It didn't fall in 11 days. It literally started falling after we reduced our forces after the surge. And it, took a big upward tick in falling after President Trump made his deal with the Taliban, and then took a bigger, leap forward in falling after President Biden made his announcement. So this didn't happen in 11 days. And people shouldn't be using that line, right? It's catchy, but it's just not accurate.
Yeah, Olivia, if I could just say to the, as a former chief of station in Afghanistan in 2008, 2009, Michael, you made a very good point. When those district assessments and those Afghan security assessments from CIA came out, I would be the face of it to the military, and you would take a lot of heat because oftentimes, in a good-natured way, but they were diametrically opposed in terms of their thoughts on the readiness of the Afghan security forces. I'll tell you the SIGAR reports, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction reports. 51 of them were issued on a quarterly basis, and I didn't read all of them, but I perused quite a few of them, and very, very negative assessments, so scathing at times on sort of the readiness levels of the Afghan security forces. And that's over time. You'd be hard pressed to find a SIGAR report that's positive. Now that may be the nature of inspector generals, but people saw this coming and knew this was happening, and it was being reported in many channels.
Can I just say one more thing, Olivia? Probably screwing up your time here, but
important thing.
I think this is important. I think the intelligence community is being blamed here because I think there was a real policy failure, not necessarily in the decision to leave, but in the effectuating that decision, right? In the implementation of that decision. Maybe we can talk about that next. But what I wanted to say was back in 2012, when President Obama was trying to figure out what his stay behind force number was going to be after the drawdown from the surge. And Mike will know how many deputies meetings and principals meetings and NSC meetings we had with the president on that. It seemed to go on forever. I prepped, right, for every one of those. And in one of those prep sessions, I actually asked everybody in my office, all of the experts, the analysts and the operations officers, if we left, how long would it take for Kabul to fall? And, various people, thought a little bit longer, a year and a half. Some people had caveats on it, but the two people at CIA who had spent more time in Afghanistan than anybody else, two chiefs of station who had both served twice as chief of station, and Phil and Mike know who they are. They both said without hesitation, Kabul will fall in less than 6 months. And I remember taking that to the White House and putting that on the table way back in 2012.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with more Intelligence Matters. Stay with us.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Why don't we do another quick round robin of how you would characterize all that's happened? I mean, so General Milley called the withdrawal from Afghanistan a logistical success and the war a strategic failure. Of course, the administration, to include the president, have cast it more positively, calling the withdrawal an extraordinary success. So why don't we have each of you describe, how would each of you describe this process? Sure, Mike Vickers, let's start.
So it is the strategic failure. I think, you know, General Milley is not always very precise with his words, but in this case, I think he was. And, you know, it's hard to call it anything but when your enemy for 20 years has taken over the country and is sitting in the Capitol. And so, you know, I think that is an accurate statement. And so, and you know, and it's a heroic logistical act. You could call it extraordinary, whatever you want. You know, all the brilliant tactics and operations and logistics in the world don't make up for strategic failure. The consequences lie in what happens strategically. And so then the question is, what happened? You know, certainly for me, it was very personal and seeing something I'd spent, you know, off and on 40 years of my life in. But this is the first, besides my own personal feelings, this is the first defeat America suffered in war since Vietnam. You know, so it's a gut punch to our country. And then there's strategic consequences about both for counterterrorism and what our other adversaries think about this display. You rest assured the Chinese and the Russians aren't calling this a great American success.
Yeah. Why don't we go to Phil and then we'll go to Michael.
Sure. I would characterize it as Mike did, as a strategic failure of significant proportions. Yes, the logistical efforts to pull people out were absolutely heroic. There's stories to be written and told eventually in the fullness of time. Those were official efforts by U.S. military and other government agencies to pulling out many, many thousands. And there was an absolutely remarkable part of a sort of a gray effort of former SOF operators and other government officials, formers, who got together and helped pull out hundreds, if not thousands, of other people. So this is a story that's tremendous, but that's not a victory. The it is a strategic failure. Today, tonight, the Minister of Interior in Afghanistan is Siraj Haqqani, who has more American blood in his hands than anybody but Osama bin Laden. We killed Osama bin Laden. So the guy who has the most blood on his hands is Siraj Haqqani. He's the Minister of Interior. It's an abject failure.
Michael?
So I'm going to focus, you know, I agree that the war was a strategic failure, right? And we can talk forever about why that's the case. But for me, the implementation of the decision to leave was not an extraordinary success. Yes. You know, once it was obvious that we had taken way too long to begin to leave, it was a logistical success in terms of getting most folks out, but not all, right? Let's not forget that. It should have been, the withdrawal should have started much, much sooner than it did. I don't know what happened. But this took way too long. It got too crunched at the end. 13 Americans are dead. I find that very difficult to call an extraordinary success.
Those are pretty candid and harsh assessments. I agree that we could spend a lot of time talking about this. I do want to shift a little bit into what is ahead, both in terms of the overall threat picture and what the architecture of the counterterrorism mission will or should like overall. I was going to start with Phil. I am going to assume, given what you just said, that you don't believe that we are dealing with a Taliban 2.0 or a changed Taliban. I'm going to assume that you think that, as General Milley put it, the enemy is in Kabul. There is some consideration being given to recognizing the Taliban as a legitimate government. What effect would that have?
Yeah, I don't believe they've changed. And you're correct, assuming that would be my position. No indications thus far. Again, with the placement into official positions of some of the people, including Haqqani that I just mentioned, it's a deliberate poke at us and an indication that they're not serious. Haqqani is al-Qaeda related, affiliated, and they're now in positions of power. I think the Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other elements, it'll be too great of an opportunity, too great of a PR capability to not launch something from Afghanistan against us. And so I think that's going to be in the works. Yes, the Taliban wants recognition. Yes, they want foreign aid. They're going to have to change, it seems to me, mightily. I get texts by the hour from former colleagues and military colleagues with some graphic atrocities being committed in Afghanistan as we speak. So they haven't changed.
Mike Vickers, maybe you can weigh in a little bit too. And I wonder if it's clear to you that the Taliban is even going to be able to consolidate and maintain power even at this early stage. I mean, even if we take at face value your commitment not to allow terror groups to reconstitute, which I'm not sure how many people do, will they, this, you know, group of 70,000 different tribal factions, be able to control their own territory and the 40 million people who are residing on it to prevent that from happening?
No, they're going to have great difficulty. You know, not only will they have, you know, they have to worry about a civil war breaking out at some point, you know, if the repression is too strong, and particularly in the non-Pashtun areas, you know, of the north and west. But they also, you know, Taliban strength is varied, you know, between 30,000 or so and maybe surging, you know, for brief periods of time to 60,000. They're not going to be able to pacify Afghanistan any more than we could with 150,000 troops and a lot better technology. And so groups like the Pakistani Taliban that use Afghanistan for sanctuary are talking about doing the same thing in Pakistan, and I would expect to see an uptick in violence there. Groups like ISIS-K that the Taliban is opposed to, ISIS Khorasan, the branch of ISIS that's in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, they will enjoy some autonomy. Taliban may go after them, but with some effect. But Phil hit on an important point. The big winner here is really Al-Qaeda, you know, that we had largely defeated in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. And they will not, there will be more foreign fighters going to Afghanistan. And Al-Qaeda, with its strong ties to Siraj Akhani and others, Pakistani Taliban, among others, will be able to reconstitute. It may take them 2 years, typically does or more, but, you know, our lessons again from 9/11 on, you know, after we defeated Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in 2001, they were able to regroup in Afghanistan-Pakistan border region starting about 2004. So by 2006, we had the transatlantic airline plot that was on the scale of 9/11, unfortunately broken up by very good intelligence.
Right, Michael. So Mike laid out just a lot of what are very real concerns. I mean, Pentagon leadership this week said that they're not confident that the U.S. is going to be able to deny either ISIS or Al-Qaeda the ability to use Afghanistan as a launch pad for terror attacks. Milley, I think, said that it could happen in as few as 6 months. So can you just talk us through a little bit? What are the key determinants of whether that happens and how fast that happens?
Yeah, I just want to very quickly say that I agree that we're not dealing with a new Taliban, and I agree that they're going to provide safe haven to terrorist groups, most importantly, Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda is intent on rebuilding its capability to attack the homeland, no doubt about it. And I agree 100% with Mike that that if they are allowed to do it, it will happen very quickly. One of the things we've learned, as Mike said, is that terrorist groups are able to reconstitute very quickly when you take the pressure off of them. So, you know, I'd say 6 months to a year before they're in a position to attack us. And that's pretty quick, right? So how do we prevent that? We would have to do two things. We would have to have two capabilities, and we would have to have one political factor. The two capabilities are, number one, and a significant intelligence capability. And I'd break that into two pieces. The first piece is to collect intelligence on the plans, intentions, and capabilities of Al-Qaeda so that we know when they're getting to the point where they're posing again a significant threat to the US. And then the second type of intelligence is when they've reached that point, and when the president has made a decision that we need to degrade them, we need to provide the precision intelligence that the military is going to need to do their over-the-horizon attacks, right? Let's take drones, for example. Drones don't know where to go unless a specific piece of intelligence tells them where to go and look. These are not broad search tools, right? So you need that kind of intelligence capability, right? Both kinds. And then secondly, you need a military capability to reach in and touch Al-Qaeda and degrade them when you have to do that. Mike is in a much better position to talk about what those capabilities are than I am. The third point I make is this political thing, which is even if the intelligence communities identify that Al-Qaeda is reconstituting and again posing a significant threat, and even if the military has the capability, whoever the president is has to have the political will in order to order that degradation, right? So those are the three things you need. I'm not worried about our ability to figure out how to do the first two. I'm a little worried about where the resources are going to come to do that, because we want to shift resources to our strategic peer competitors, China and Russia, and we are going to take them from CT. Well, I don't know if that's going to work anymore. So if we spend the resources and have the focus, I think we can do one and two. Three worries me a little bit, given that I think most politicians want to forget about Afghanistan. So I worry that a future president might be in a position where they're not willing to take action when they have to.
So Mike Vickers, I want to hear from you in the waning minutes that we have left, because details are really, really sparse on how the administration's over the horizon strategy is going to work in Afghanistan. One thing we did learn from congressional testimony this week is that the U.S. still doesn't have any basing agreements with any neighboring countries. We also now see the Taliban warning of unspecified consequences if the U.S. continues to fly drones over its territory. They're citing the Doha Agreement that the U.S. says is binding as being in violation of that. China is endorsing that view. So if you were advising the administration on how this would work, what would you say are the requirements for a successful, predominantly, if not exclusively, over the horizon counterterrorism strategy in Afghanistan?
Well, no one would choose, no counterterrorism strategist that I know would choose an over the horizon capability over a closer in or in country capability. And that's why I think this was such a strategically fraught decision to not have a small counterterrorism presence left in country, mostly special operators and intelligence personnel. And the reason for that is, as Michael outlined, this is mostly an intelligence war, and your intelligence degrades as the further away you get. Also, the further away you get in flight time, particularly for instruments like drones, which are slow flying aircraft, you spend an awful lot of time in transit rather than in target. So if we had to fly from the Persian Gulf, for example, which we have the capability of doing, it's hardly desirable from a time on target point of view. So we won't be as effective as we otherwise would be by a long shot. That said, if we maintain an over-the-horizon capability, all our other over-the-horizon capabilities, again, which are really not by choice, they're dictated by circumstance, are much closer to their target areas than likely will be in Afghanistan. If we maintain one, we'll still be better off than we were pre-9/11. And under the conditions that Michael talked about, if we have the will to use it and everything else, it's still better than nothing, but it's hardly as good as an in-country presence.
Phil, I'd welcome your view on this too. How is it done with no human network whatsoever, assuming there's none? Would the CIA have been able to construct something like a leave behind network of human assets that could function in a Taliban run Afghanistan? If so, would such a network have been able to survive the upheaval of these final weeks? Talk to us a little bit about what possibilities exist there.
Sure. The human capability won't deteriorate immediately. It will deteriorate over time. But yes, there were capabilities left in place that will be brought to bear. But again, they will attrit and eventually deteriorate over time. So without the boots on the ground, we, U.S. intelligence community and U.S. military, got very, very good at prosecuting operations against senior Taliban and AQ figures because of the basing and boots on the ground. Again, that's all gone, of course, so that's not going to be there. Some point that Michael made, I think it's a very good one. Will future administrations have the stomach to utilize these capabilities and pull the trigger when necessary? Not only pull the trigger, but realize mistakes are going to be made, like they were tragically several weeks ago in Kabul. This could happen again, and they have to be prepared for that. That's one of the penalties or risks with over the horizon. You're not going to have the granularity that we had with human sources on the ground.
Yeah, let's briefly just talk about that strike, because how does what the Pentagon said about how it was carried out sort of sit with you? I mean, General McKenzie said it was a self-defense strike based on an imminent threat that precluded the opportunity to develop pattern of life. You know, to what extent are those factors or non-factors when you're talking overall about over the horizon? Phil, feel free to jump in and Mike thereafter.
Well, I mean, I remember something, in fact, General Hayden said back when he was the director, you want it bad, you get it bad. I think this was rushed. There was a real strong, understandable desire for retribution, and unfortunately, the wrong dots were connected. There were dissenting views, I understand, from the press and in the community, perhaps, on this. But again, they were up against a clock and decided to move. And tragically, things like this can happen. I would say, in my experience, it is extremely rare. Extremely rare when any element of the USG does one of these kinetic operations. The military has made mistakes. It did so in this case, but that is very much a minority of these operations.
Mike, if you'd like to add, feel free.
Yeah, this strike was tragic, but it was also under very unusual circumstances for counterterrorism, you know, a real in extremis case. Normally, you develop targets over time. And in fact, what gives these operations their greatest precision is that, you know, you really have time usually to make sure that you're right. And so if you see that children go in the area or something, you wait till they leave. You may wait a month in some cases before you do a strike. And that's the benefit of having real persistent presence, is that you can get that kind of precision and wage a strategic campaign. You know, I would say our most successful counterterrorism campaign against Al-Qaeda, because ISIS was like 2001, it was a mixture of Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but was really in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region. And that's where we weren't over the horizon. That's where we were close in, and we developed intelligence over years, you know, as Phil and Michael both know, and we were able to bring everything to bear.
Let's talk a little bit about Pakistan. And again, the just few minutes that we have left, I am assuming that each of you will have some thoughts about Pakistan, its relationship with the Taliban going forward. So Michael Morrell, why don't we start with you? You know, how do you see Pakistan's relationship with the Taliban? How do you see the relationship between our intelligence services and the ISI going forward? Let's just keep it broad there, and then we can drill down if we can salvage the time.
Sure. I think Pakistan is about ready to pay the price for their 20-year support of the Afghan Taliban. And the reason I say that is because the Pakistani Taliban, which wants to overthrow the Pakistani state and routinely conducts attacks in Pakistan, used to be in Pakistan when there were large number of US forces in Afghanistan where the Pakistani military could get at them. Now, guess where they are? Now they're in Afghanistan. And now they're coming across the border into Pakistan to conduct attacks. They just did one a few weeks ago in Karachi, right? So the Pakistanis now face an enemy that they can't get at, right? So I do think there's some mutual interest here. You know, I think it would make sense for the United States, and maybe we've done this already, I don't know, but for the United States to go to the Pakistanis and not ask for basing rights, right? That's a little too quick. They're not politically able to do that at the moment. But say to them, let's work together on intelligence collection in Afghanistan. We need to collect intelligence on Al-Qaeda and ISIS. You need to collect intelligence on the Pakistani Taliban and ISIS. So let's work together. I think there's a mutual interest, and you know, it could be kept secret. I think we should make the pitch.
Mike, I see you're raring to go.
And it's an interesting idea. One of the, you know, probably the most unusual thing about our Afghan war since 2001 is not its duration, even though it's America's longest war. It's the fact that an ally of ours was really aiding our enemy for 20 years. And so we had both an ally and someone aiding an enemy at the same time. And that's why we call them a frenemy, I suppose, you know, a new word we made up. And I think Michael's right about potentially some common interest. I would add that Pakistani-U.S. cooperation was best right after 9/11, and it lasted until about 2010, and then it really deteriorated. And it deteriorated actually before bin Laden. And we offered them all kinds of intelligence support in the border region when, as Michael said, the Pakistani Taliban were in Pakistan and killing lots of Pakistanis, and they wouldn't take it. They didn't want us to see their support for the Taliban, you know, waving them through the border and other things, which we saw anyway, et cetera. So they wouldn't take that cooperation. So while I'd like to believe that they would take it now, I'm pretty skeptical. Since 2010 and 11, they've been really thinking they're going to drive the U.S. out of Afghanistan, and then they're turning to China. And that's what they've increasingly been doing.
Mike, I'm just looking for any way to get close to Afghanistan with our intelligence assets.
Well, me too.
Olivia, there was always a crazy, from my perspective, duality to the relationship with the Pakistanis, and my colleagues have touched upon it. They house the Haqqani network. They house the Quetta Shura. Yet they lost thousands of troops in the Fatah, fighting different Taliban elements, and at times prosecuting or assisting us in prosecuting very, very sensitive operations, only to then publicly complain about them in the press. So it always was a real duality. But to the point of they may have bitten off more than they can swallow here, you know, just last week in the Red Mosque in Islamabad was flying the Taliban flag. Now, they ultimately had to take it down, but they may have uncorked something now. They may have a hard time controlling.
That was our discussion on Afghanistan. Please join us next week for another edition of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today. The show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Paulina Smolinski, and Ashley Armstrong. Additional production support by the Hayden Center's Matt Fay. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS News.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.